It's time now for the Northern Storyteller. Hi, I'm Lee Salisbury, and today I'll be reading the story, The 50-Yard Dash, from the book, My Name is Aaron, by William Sorone. After a certain letter came to me from New York the year I was 12, I made up my mind to become the most powerful man in the neighborhood. The letter was from my friend Lionel Strongfort. I'd put the coupon from Argosy All Story magazine, signed it, placed it in the envelope, and mailed it to him. And he'd written back promptly, with an enthusiasm bordering on pure delight, saying, I was undoubtedly a man of uncommon intelligence, potentially a giant, and unlike the average run-of-the-mill people of the world who were, in a manner of speaking, dreamwalkers and daydreamers, a person who would someday be somebody. His opinion of me was very much like my own. It was pleasant, however, to have the opinion so emphatically corroborated, particularly by a man in New York, and a man with the greatest chest expansion in the world. With the letter came several photographic reproductions of Mr. Strongfort, wearing nothing but a little bit of leopard skin. He was a tremendous man and claimed that at one time he'd been puny. He was loaded all over with muscle and appeared to be somebody who could lift a 1920 Ford Roadster and tip it over. It was an honor to have him for a friend. The only trouble was, I didn't have the money. I forget how much the exact figure was at the beginning of our acquaintanceship, but I haven't forgotten that it was an amount completely out of the question. While I was eager to be grateful to Mr. Strongfort for his enthusiasm, I didn't seem to be able to find words with which to explain about not having the money without immediately appearing to be a dreamwalker and a daydreamer myself. So, while waiting from one day to another, looking everywhere for words that would not blight our friendship and degrade me to commonness, I talked the matter over with my Uncle Zico, who was studying Oriental philosophy at that time. He was amazed at my curious ambition, but quite pleased. He said, the secret of greatness, according to yoga, was the releasing within oneself of those mysterious vital forces which are in all men. These strengths, he said in English, which he liked to accept when speaking to me, is from God. I tell you, Aram, it is wonderful. I told him I couldn't begin to become the powerful man I'd decided to become until I sent Mr. Strongfort some money. Money, my uncle said with contempt. I tell you, Aram, money is nothing. You cannot bribe God. Although my Uncle Zico wasn't exactly a puny man, he was certainly not the man Lionel Strongfort was. In a wrestling match, I felt certain Mr. Strongfort would get a headlock or a half Nelson or a toehold on my uncle and either make him give up or squeeze him to death. And then again, on the other hand, I wondered. My uncle was nowhere near as big as Mr. Strongfort, but neither was Mr. Strongfort as dynamically furious as my uncle. It seemed to me that, at best, Mr. Strongfort, in a match with my uncle, would have a great deal of unfamiliar trouble. I mean, with the mysterious vital forces that were always getting released in my uncle, so that very often a swift glance from him would make a big man quail and turn away, or, if he had been speaking, stop quickly. Long before I'd discovered words with which to explain to Mr. Strongfort about the money, another letter came from him. It was as cordial as the first, and as a matter of fact, if anything, a little more cordial. I was delighted and ran about, releasing mysterious vital forces, turning handsprings, scrambling up trees, turning somersaults, trying to tip over 1924 roadsters, challenging all comers to wrestle, and in many other ways alarming my relatives and irritating the neighbors. Not only was Mr. Strongfort not sore at me, he had reduced the cost of the course. Even so, the money necessary was still more than I could get hold of. I was selling papers every day, but that money was for bread and stuff like that. For a while, I got up very early every morning and went around town looking for a small satchel full of money. During 6 days of this adventuring, I found a nickel and 2 pennies. I also found a woman's purse containing several foul-smelling cosmetic items, no money, and a slip of paper on which was written in an ignorant hand, Steve Hertwig, 3764 Ventura Avenue. 3 days after the arrival of Mr. Strongfort's second letter, his third letter came. From this time on, our correspondence became one-sided. In fact, I didn't write at all. Mr. Stoneforth's communications were overpowering and not at all easy to answer without money. There was, in fact, almost nothing to say. It was winter time when the first letter came, and it was then that I made up my mind to become the most powerful man in my neighborhood, and ultimately, for all I knew, one of the most powerful men in the world. I had ideas of my own as to how to go about getting that way, but I had also the warm friendship and high regard of Mr. Stoneforth in New York, and the mystical and curious guardianship of my Uncle Vito at home. The letters from Mr. Stoneforth continued to arrive every 2 or 3 days all winter and on into springtime. I remember the day apricots were ripe enough to steal, and the arrival of a most charming letter from my friend in New York. It was a hymn to newness on earth, the arrival of springtime, the time of youth in the heart, of renewal, fresh strength, fresh determination, and many other things. It was truly a beautiful epistle, probably as fine as any to the Romans or anybody else. It was full of the legend quality, the world feeling, and the dignity of sense feeling so characteristic of biblical days. The last paragraph of the lovely hymn brought up, apologetically, the coarse theme of money. The sum was 6 or 7 times as little as it had been originally, and a new element had come into Mr. Stoneforth's program of changing me over from a nobody to a giant of tremendous strength and extreme attractiveness to women. Mr. Stoneforth had decided, he said, to teach me everything in one fell swoop, or one sweet fall, or something of that sort. At any rate, for $3, he said, he would send me all his precious secrets in one envelope, and the rest would be up to me and history. I took the matter up with my Uncle Vito, who by this time had reached the stage of fasting, meditating, walking for hours, and vibrating. We had discussions 2 or 3 times a week all winter, and he told me in his own unique broken English way all the secrets he had been learning from yoga. "I tell you, Aram," he said, "I can do anything. It is wonderful." I believed him, too. Even though he'd lost a lot of weight, couldn't sleep, and had a strange, dynamic blaze in his eyes. He was very scornful of the world that year and was full of pity for the dumb, beautiful animals that man was mistreating, killing, eating, domesticating, and teaching to do tricks. "I tell you, Aram," he said, "it is criminal to make horses work, to kill the cows, to teach the dogs to jump, and the monkeys to smoke pipes." I told him about the letter from Mr. Stoneforth. "Money," he said. "Always he wants money. I do not like him." My uncle was getting all of his information free from the Theosophy, Philosophy, Astrology, and Miscellaneous shelf at the public library. He believed, however, that he was getting it straight from God. Before he took up yoga, he'd been one of the boys around town and a good drinker of raki. But after the light began to come to him, he gave up drinking. He said he was drinking liquor finer than raki or anything else. "What's that?" I asked him. "Aram," he said, "it is wisdom." Anyhow, he had a little use for Mr. Stoneforth and regarded the man as a charlatan. "He's all right," I told my uncle. But my uncle became furious, releasing mysterious vital forces, and said, "I will break his head, fooling all you little kids." "He ain't fooling," I said. "He says he'll give me all his secrets for $3. "I tell you, Aram," my uncle Peter said, "he does not know any secrets. He is a liar." "I don't know," I said. "I'd like to try that stuff out." "It is criminal," my Uncle Vito said. "But I will give you $3. My Uncle Vito gave me the necessary $3, and I sent them along to Mr. Stoneforth. The envelope came from New York, full of Mr. Stoneforth's secrets. It was strangely simple. It was all stuff I'd known anyhow, but had been too lazy to pay any attention to. The idea was to get up early in the morning and for an hour or so to do various kinds of acrobatic exercises, which were illustrated. Also to drink plenty of water, get plenty of fresh air, eat good wholesome food, and keep it up until you were a giant. I felt a little let down and sent Mr. Stoneforth a short, polite note saying so. He ignored the note, and I never heard from him again. In the meantime, I had been following the rules and growing more powerful every day. When I say in the meantime, I mean for 4 days I followed the rules. On the 5th day, I decided to sleep instead of getting up and filling the house with noise and getting my grandmother sore. She used to wake up in the darkness of early morning and shout, "You're an impractical fool and never be rich." She would then go back to sleep for 5 minutes, wake up, and then shout, "You'll never buy and sell for a profit." She would sleep a little more, waken and shout, "There were once three sons of a king. One was wise like his father, the other was crazy about girls, and the third had less brains than a bird." Then she'd get out of bed and, shouting steadily, tell me the whole story while I did my exercises. The story would usually warn me to be sensible and not go around waking her up before daybreak all the time. That would always be the moral, more or less, although the story itself would be about three sons of some king, or three brothers, each of them very wealthy and usually very greedy, or three daughters, or three proverbs, or three roads, or something else like that. She was wasting her breath, though, because I wasn't enjoying the early morning acrobatics any more than she was. In fact, I was beginning to feel it was a lot of nonsense and that my Uncle Duco had been right about Mr. Strongfort in the first place. So, I gave up Mr. Strongfort's program and returned to my own, which is more or less as follows: to take it easy and grow to be the most powerful man in the neighborhood without any trouble or exercise, which is what I did. That spring, Longfellow School announced that a track meet was to be held, one school to compete against another, everybody to participate. Here, I believe, was my chance. In my opinion, I would be first in every event. Somehow or other, however, continuous meditation on the theme of athletics had the effect of growing into a fury of anticipation that continued all day and night, so that before the day of the track meet, I had run the 50-yard dash any number of hundreds of times. Had jumped the running broad jump, the standing broad jump, and the high jump, and in each event had made my competitors look like weaklings. This tremendous inner activity, which was strictly yoga, changed on the day of attack meet into fever. The time came at last for me and three other athletes, one of them a Greek, to go to our mark, get set and go. And I did, in a blind rush of speed which I knew had never before occurred in the history of athletics. It seemed to me that never before had any living man moved so swiftly. Within myself, I ran the 50 yards 50 times before I so much as opened my eyes to find out how far back I had left the other runners. I was very much amazed at what I saw. Three boys were 4 yards ahead of me and going away. It was incredible. It was unbelievable. But it was obviously the truth. There ought to be some mistake, but there wasn't. There they were, ahead of me, simply going away. Well, it simply meant I'd have to overtake them with my eyes open and win the race. This I proceeded to do. They continued, incredibly, however, to go away in spite of my intention. I became irritated and decided to put them in their places for the impertinence and began releasing all the mysterious vital forces within myself that I had. Somehow or other, however, not even this seemed to bring me any closer to them, and I felt that in some strange way I was being betrayed. If so, I decided, I would shame my betrayer by winning the race in spite of the betrayal, and once again, I threw fresh life and energy into my running. There wasn't a great distance still to go, but I knew that I'd be able to do it. Then I knew I wouldn't. The race was over. I was last by 10 yards. Without the slightest hesitation, I protested and challenged the runners to another race, same distance back. They refused to consider the proposal, which proved I knew that they were afraid to race me. I told them they knew very well I could beat them. It was very much the same in all the other events. When I got home, I was in a high fever and very angry. I was delirious all night and 6 3 days. My grandmother took good care of me and was probably responsible for my not dying. When my Uncle Duco came to visit me, he was no longer hollow-cheeked. It seems he had finished his fast, which had been a long one, 40 days or so, and nights too, I believe. He'd stopped meditating, too, because he had practically exhausted the subject. He was again one of the boys around town, drinking, staying up all hours, and following the women. "I tell you, Adam," he said, "we are a great family. We can do anything." You've been listening to the story of a 50-yard dash from the book My Name is Alan by William Saroyan, published by Harcourt Brace, New York. Made in Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM in Fairbanks. The program was coordinated by Ron Inouye and produced by Robert Gilfillan. Our executive producer is Carlo Camilla, and I'm Lee Salisbury.